president did on Tuesday night are for people who are very well connected. They were for financial, white collar crimes and campaign finance violations. And, you know, what jumped out to me as you read the name on the full list of pardons were some of the people who were vouching for these pardon recipients. It was people like Pam Bondi, Daryl Scott, Christopher Ruddy. These are all friends and strong supporters of President Trump.
There was one name on the list that is not a household name, but he is a former member of Congress, Mark Siljander. What did he do?
He was a Michigan congressman who later, as a lobbyist, took money from a group with ties to a terror group. But he has close ties to prominent evangelicals. And earlier this week, you know, Trump pardoned several other former congressmen who had been convicted of white-collar crimes.
So with less than a month left in his presidency, how does President Trump's use of the pardon power compare to presidents who came before him?
He's offered clemency, pardons, and commutations to more than 90 people. That's a lot more than President George W. Bush did in his first term or President Obama did in his first term. But at the same time, what's different about Trump is that he is pardoning very high profile people that are close to him, his friends and his associates. And that's very different.
NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe. Thanks, Aisha.
Thank you.
Okay, so Congress thought it had tied up most of its work before leaving for the holidays, but President Trump apparently had different ideas. Yesterday, he vetoed the annual defense bill, and the day before that, he harshly criticized the massive COVID relief bill that was passed after a lot of work. That caught many off guard, including Republican Congressman Tom Reed, who spoke to NPR yesterday.
Obviously, it caught all of us by surprise. Many of us were blindsided by this action by the president.
And now each party seems to have a different plan to respond. And let's bring in NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales. Hi, Claudia.
Good morning, David.
Let's start with that bill that was vetoed, the Defense Authorization Act. It's known as the NDAA. Remind us what was in there and why the president vetoed it.
Yes, this is the policy bill for the Pentagon. So it includes pay raises, boosts in troop levels and equipment. And the veto isn't a surprise. Trump threatened to veto this bill several times in the last several months. He first took issue with the bill's plans to rename military bases that honor figures from the Confederacy. And then he wanted a last minute provision repealing a liability shield for social media companies. And then finally, he said that it didn't sufficiently address China.
So what happens now?
So because this wasn't a surprise, Congress already made plans to meet to override this veto next week, and it appears that they have the majorities needed to do so. And that's because when they passed the final version of this legislation earlier this month, they drew these kind of overwhelming votes already. So the House is expected to meet to override this veto. They'll need two-thirds of their members to agree. And if that clears the lower chamber, it will move to the Senate for similar approval by Tuesday.
Okay, so they had a plan in place for that. It seems like they had no plan for the president throwing a wrench in the COVID relief deal that they had worked for months on. That came out of nowhere.
Exactly. And there's little appetite to address his demands, even in his own party, and frankly, little time. This Congress ends on January 3rd. And again, it took months of this bitter partisan fighting to reach this point. One House Republican, Nebraska's Dom Bacon, told his colleagues on a call yesterday that Trump basically threw them under the bus. And he noted in a statement afterwards, confirming that he had said this, that he was told by the White House to support the bill on Monday, the same day of the vote. So the frustration is palpable. Meanwhile, House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy said last night in a letter to his colleagues that Republicans will try to seek quick approval on a new proposal, and that's to revisit the foreign aid section of this package. This was one of Trump's major criticisms this week, pointing to how much foreign aid was included in the plan, but we expect that attempt to get shot down.
Well, then there's this amazing twist, too, especially in this time of partisanship. Democrats loved one thing that Trump called for, larger direct payments to Americans. They were like, glad you've come around to our idea.
Exactly. Today, they'll open up the House floor session asking to get quick approval for this plan that Trump was demanding. So this will happen under what's known as unanimous consent. They're trying to capitalize on this moment, but we're expecting it to get blocked by Republicans. Meanwhile, they have a lot to consider over the holiday break, because if the president doesn't sign off on this package in the coming days, they'll need to pass a new government funding measure by Monday to avoid a government shutdown.
All right. A busier holiday than expected for many lawmakers. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales. Claudia, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Doctors and nurses at some of the top hospitals in the country say that people with the most exposure to COVID patients are not always the people getting the vaccine first. As Gabriella Emanuel of member station GBH in Boston reports, some people are saying the distribution has been like a free-for-all.
For 16 years, Jennifer DeVincent has been a nurse in the Mass General Brigham Hospital system. It's been stressful this year in her neonatal intensive care unit because some mothers have tested positive for COVID. So she was thrilled about the vaccine coming. But last week, the scheduling system crashed. Too many users. When it was up again, DeVincent was busy with a patient.
I remember I was sitting there in the rocker feeding the baby as I was hearing nurses talk from outside the room in the hallway.
There was a commotion as they realized that within minutes, all the appointments were gone. Many night shift workers woke up to learn they'd slept through the announcement of the new system and the sign-up windows.
It turned into somewhat of a free-for-all. And, you know, those that work the most have had the hardest time getting an appointment because you can't always log on at that exact moment.
DeVincent, who is still unvaccinated, says her frustration turned to anger when she realized exactly who would be getting the shots. Some were managers, coordinators, people who didn't do hands-on patient care. Mass General Brigham is using an honor code system. Employees are supposed to self-police and not skip ahead.
It definitely feels a little bit like a slap in the face.
It absolutely did create a frenzy, which is the opposite of what we wanted to do with this system. And it's something that we're working very hard on addressing right now.
Paul Bittinger is overseeing the vaccine rollout at Mass General Brigham. He says they didn't manage expectations well, given the limited number of vaccines. But he says using the honor code is necessary with a staff of more than 80,000.
It's actually relatively complex to figure out who is working where. We have staff who move among our hospitals and work in different roles in different hospitals.
He's been going through the data and says it was relatively rare for people to jump the line and usually a misunderstanding. He says they're working on making the guidelines a lot clearer and fixing issues in the app. While vaccine rollout has gone smoothly at many hospitals, the issues at Mass General Brigham are not unique. Similar challenges have arisen at places like New York Presbyterian and Stanford Medicine.
I do think that these are initial stumbles.
Julie Swan is an expert in supply chains who advised the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on distributing the H1N1 vaccine. She's betting things will get a lot smoother quickly since supply is increasing. But she says there are techniques to make sure the right people get vaccinated.
One way is to send information out first just to the smallest group that is eligible for the vaccine and get them registered first.
Swan says the test of whether hospitals can do better will be in the coming weeks as they receive and distribute many more doses of the vaccines. For NPR News, I'm Gabriella Emanuel.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:19 right now. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. And here's what's coming up later this hour. The false information President Trump and others have spread about November's election has real effects.
I've been threatened more times than I could even count. I can't even begin to describe what effect this has had on my life.
The disinformation campaign leaves some voting system workers afraid for their lives. That story's in 15 minutes.
Listener support is the largest source of funding for the high-quality WPR programs and content you've come to expect on your radio, at WPR.org, on your phone, tablet, or smart speaker. Your year-end gift today affirms your commitment to a strong, independent public radio service. Give now. Your support is essential. At WPR.org. Thank you.
Support for WPR comes from All of Us Wisconsin, dedicated to helping speed up health research breakthroughs by asking 1 million people to share health information. Details at joinallofus.org/Wisconsin.
Support comes from the Choral Arts Society, premiering a YouTube video review of past Christmas concerts December 29th at 7 p.m., followed by a video conference afterglow. In conjunction, the Sebastians is offering a special curbside pickup dinner. Visit choralartsonline.org.
In fact, through tonight, for Bayfield, Ashland, and Iron counties, a winter weather advisory for Vilas County until 9 this morning. Cloudy skies today, cold snow showers for central and southern Wisconsin. Snow continues in the north and northeast. Additional accumulations of up to 7 inches possible in the warning area and another few inches in the advisory area. Highs mostly in the single digits today, but reaching the low teens in the south. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One. Offering Capital One Shopping, a downloadable browser extension that searches various sites for shoppers. What's in your wallet? More at CapitalOneShopping.com. From Avalara, managing sales tax compliance with cloud-based solutions. Avalara integrates directly with more than 700 ERP and e-commerce solutions. Avalara, tax compliance done right. From AT&T, committed to keeping students and teachers connected. AT&T has connected more than 200 million students with tools and technology for distance learning. More at att.com/remote learning. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King. Every month, NPR and Kaiser Health News take a close look at a medical bill that you send us because there is so much craziness in the world of medical billing. Here to tell us about the latest one is Elizabeth Rosenthal. She's the editor-in-chief at our partner, Kaiser Health News. Hey, Elizabeth, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
All right, Elizabeth, what's this month's bill?
This one is about a simple little test that generated a huge lab fee. Listeners may recall that our very first bill of the month 3 years ago touched on a similar theme, and it's still happening. Dan Weissman of An Arm and a Leg podcast talked to Lorraine Rogge, who sent us this bill. Let's listen.
For years, Lorraine Rogge's husband had nursed a fantasy of selling the house, buying an RV, and hitting the road together full time. She thought,
this is not going to happen. We can't afford this. He's crazy.
Suddenly, her husband got super sick. Doctors said he had a 20% chance of living.
I was scared. I thought I was going to live. I mean, 20%? That means like an 80% chance of dying.
He had a request.
He says, if I survive this, can we go on the road? I got out my little spreadsheet, did all my calculations, and I said, if we stick to this budget, we can do it.
He pulled through. Since 2015, the RV has been their only home all across the country. Last spring, they holed up at a remote spot in New Mexico to wait out the coronavirus surge. And in May, Lorraine had a medical problem.
Well, it's kind of a woman thing. I was using a prescription commonly used by women, and immediately I experienced cramps, pain.
When it didn't go away after a few days, she decided to see a gynecologist. She made sure to find someone who took her insurance. The doc took a sample to test for a yeast infection. Lorraine never got a call with results, but the cramping went away on its own. She figured she was in the clear. Until she got the bill from Carlsbad Medical Center.
They billed my insurance over $12,000.
And she was on the hook for more than $3,000.
In my RV budget, I have a category for shit happens. This year has been a really bad year, and that category has almost been used up. I did not have $3,000 extra dollars this year to pay this.
So she called her insurance company.
The girl on the phone, she started telling me what tests were run. And that's when I hit the roof because they're running all these STD tests. Are you kidding me?
Lorraine distinctly remembered telling her doctor that she and her husband had been monogamous for 26 years. The woman from Lorraine's insurance was surprised, too.
And then she's looking at the prices, and even she said, this is a lot for these.
And some tests had been run more than once.
So she filed a fraud, waste, and abuse claim,
which went nowhere and left Lorraine on the hook for that $3,000. By the time that became official, Lorraine had Googled Carlsbad Medical Center and found out that they were notorious for high prices and for suing patients over unpaid bills.
And I don't want to have them decide to take me to court, and I'm like, God only knows where in the United States, and get a summons.
She reluctantly set up a payment plan and started paying $83 a month, until a reporter started digging around.
One morning, bright and early, I get a call from like some VP of finance at Carlsbad Medical Center. We're waiving your balance. No reason why, nothing. Your balance is waived.
She made sure to get that in writing. For NPR News, I'm Dan Weissman.
Okay, so things ended up fine for Lorraine, but it's not like everyone who gets a surprise medical bill can ask a reporter to try to track down what happened.
Right. This is a national tragedy, in fact. Why should it take a reporter's call for a hospital to do the right thing billing-wise? And actually, last year, Carlsbad Medical Center got absolutely slammed in the media, featured in the New York Times for their high billing practices. But of course, Lorraine didn't know that at the time, and it appears it hasn't changed its ways.
Why was she billed $12,000 for what sounds like a simple lab test?
That's a good question. This was the hospital's sticker price on a bundle of lab tests for every known vaginal infection and then some. And the markup is in the stratosphere. I think patients should know tests are like booze in restaurants. They can be marked up as much as the hospital wants. Experts here we contacted said the bill should have been hundreds of dollars at the most, not thousands.
And it also sounds like Lorraine had made clear to her doctor that she didn't need some of these tests, particularly for sexually transmitted infections. She was not concerned that that was what was happening.
Yeah, she was pretty shocked. She said, look, I'm a happily married grandmother. You know, it's reasonable for a doctor to order tests for any sexually active person, but the doctor really should have had a sensitive conversation with Lorraine about that. And she says that didn't happen.
Is there anything that you would have advised her to do differently?
Well, what I tell everyone is when a doctor says, I'm just going to send off this little test, stop and say, what is it for and how much will it cost? The best defense here is a good offense. So it may cause the doctor to rethink, do I really need to order this test or the entire battery, which, of course, wasn't necessary in this case.
And then you have an update on the hospital and their lab fees?
That's right. They told us they would be revising their sticker prices, but we'll be following up to make sure.
All right. It's December, and so that means this is our last bill of the month for 2020. Is there any optimistic news for listeners? Anything we should look forward to in 2021?
Well, patients got a present recently in the big spending bill that Congress passed. There was a provision that banned surprise medical billing. It's not perfect, but it's a win for patients.
It's something. All right. Elizabeth Rosenthal, editor-in-chief at our partner Kaiser Health News. Thanks so much, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Bill of the Month will continue in 2021. If you have a bizarre medical bill, go to NPR's Shots blog and tell us about it. And this afternoon on All Things Considered, it's a very 2020 Christmas. You know what this year's popular stocking stuffers are? Hand sanitizer, rolls of toilet paper, and cleaners for keys and phones. Listen by asking your smart speaker to play NPR, or just ask for your member station by name. This is NPR News.
The pandemic has changed the way people worship with each other, but has it changed the way they communicate with their higher power?
In the days of COVID, I pray to be surrounded by good care, to have our anxieties lifted and our burdens carried, you know, by, in my case, I would say God.
Prayer in the Days of COVID, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in for All Things Considered with Brady Carlson, starting at 4 this afternoon on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
Thanks for listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In news, the number of traffic-related deaths in Wisconsin this year has surpassed the totals for each of the last 2 years. We'll have more on that story and all the latest Wisconsin news for you after an update from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. More than a million doses of COVID-19 vaccines made by Pfizer and Moderna have been administered in the U.S. since the rollouts began. As Dan Karpinchuk reports from Toronto, Moderna's vaccine is about to be introduced in Canada.
Health Canada has determined that the Moderna vaccine is effective and safe for use. The first deliveries are expected to arrive by Christmas. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says now with the green light, it will start rolling out across the country. He says this month, Canada will receive 168,000 doses, with more coming from both drug makers in January. Moderna has promised Canada 40 million doses by the end of next year. Health experts say Moderna's vaccine is a game changer because it doesn't have to be kept at the ultra-low temperatures needed for Pfizer's. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Britain and the European Union are hoping to announce a post-Brexit trade agreement before the end of the day. NPR's Frank Langfitt says negotiators from both sides worked through the night to try to resolve the few remaining issues.
If this works out, the UK will get tariff and quota-free access to the EU single market, which is nearly 450 million people. Ideally, this averts or lessens chaos we might see at the border when the transition period ends and customs kick in at the end of this month.
That's NPR's Frank Langfitt reporting from London. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. The number of traffic-related deaths in Wisconsin this year has surpassed the totals for each of the last 2 years. Figures from the State Department of Transportation show 573 fatalities as of Sunday. A study by the Wisconsin Policy Forum found that overall numbers of crashes fell in the early months of the pandemic when there were fewer cars on the road. But the number of fatal crashes rose, fueled by extreme speeding as well as impaired and distracted driving. Mark Sommerhauser of the Policy Forum says there was a national decline in fatalities during this period, even as Wisconsin and the Midwest saw increases. Until this year, Wisconsin's number of annual road deaths has been declining since 2017. A new report shows the University of Wisconsin system paid out nearly $70 million in coronavirus-related refunds to students. The Legislative Audit Bureau released a report Tuesday that shows the system paid out $68.5 million in housing and food service refunds to students after campuses closed in March in response to the pandemic. The report also found the Board of Regents approved student fee reductions at 4 2-year schools and at UW-Milwaukee heading into the fall semester to reflect a lack of athletic and performing arts programming. System President Tommy Thompson issued a statement later Tuesday saying that the system has lost $257 million this year because of the pandemic. An alleged chemical mixture inside a Neenah plant sent three employees to the hospital and forced the evacuation of workers and some residents living near the facility. The Neenah Menasha Fire Rescue received a medical call about noon reporting a sick employee at Galway. Fire Chief Kevin Cloyne says hazmat crews were sent to the scene to investigate whether chlorine was by mistake emptied into a tank filled with acid. WLUK-TV reports that the three employees were treated and released. Clone says the plant and residents within two blocks downwind of the facility were evacuated and brought to a nearby middle school. A winter storm warning in effect until tonight for Bayfield, Ashland, and Iron counties. A winter weather advisory in effect for Vilas County for about another half hour. About another 7 inches of snow possible in the warning area, 1 to 2 more in the advisory area, highs mostly in the single digits.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab. Charles Schwab is committed to offering a modern approach to wealth management with personalized financial planning to meet an investor's specific needs. Learn more at schwab.com/plan. From Heifer International, where people can discover their animal match, whether it's a goat, chicken, or alpaca, Giving an animal from Heifer provides struggling families a way to put food on their tables. More at heifer.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King in Washington, D.C.
And I'm David Green in Los Angeles. Well, President Trump's efforts to overturn the election have failed. But the president will leave office having convinced a lot of his supporters falsely that the election was stolen. And that could have big consequences for the country. It's also having a very dramatic impact on the lives of some individual Americans. And to talk about this, we have NPR's Miles Parks with us. He has covered voting in this very busy year. Miles, thanks for being here.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me.
So you've been digging into some of these conspiracy theories that the president has been pushing over the last month and a half or so. What are you finding?
Well, the volume is just staggering, honestly. I reached out to a firm that does data analysis on internet trends. They're called Signal Labs, and I asked them to look at misinformation related specifically to the election. So in the 7 or so weeks since Election Day, November 3rd, Signal found more than 40 million mentions just of vote-by-mail misinformation alone across the media spectrum, traditional media sources, and social media. So to me, this indicates two things. One, there are a lot of people in this country who believe this stuff and are sharing it. But the other thing is just how successful Trump has been at creating this whole narrative of an election theft. That 40 million number encompasses fact checks as well as misinformation and stories that are true, too. So it's just this loop of disinformation that's being spread, then it's debunked, and then it just kind of goes back and forth like that, keeping these storylines alive.
That's amazing, that 40 million number. I mean, you have to think that there's an impact there when it comes to trust in our democracy, if a lot of people just don't trust the outcome of the election and believe this stuff. But I'm curious, too. I mean, you've been reporting that there's like people's lives are being impacted here, too.
Yeah, it's really easy to forget that behind all of this bureaucracy, there are normal people at every level of these elections with lives and with families. And this flood of conspiracy theories is really hitting some of those people hard. One of those people is Eric Coomer, who's an employee at this voting company called Dominion. He's actually gone into hiding for the last month and a half or so. And this week he announced that he's suing the Trump campaign and some of its allies, alleging defamation. He talked about his experience with our colleague at Colorado Public Radio, Benta Berkland.
Eric Coomer was forced to leave his home 1 week after the presidential election ended. He's been living in hiding ever since.
I actually am in fear for my safety. I'm in fear for my family's safety. These are real, tangible things coming out of these baseless accusations.
Coomer is the director of product strategy and security for Denver-based Dominion Voting Systems. The company provides election equipment and software to 28 states. President Trump has falsely claimed that its machines fraudulently switched votes to Biden. Some of Trump's supporters have come to focus on Coomer as the supposed mastermind of a plot to steal the election. Coomer's defamation lawsuit accuses Trump's allies of spreading falsehoods that intentionally inflicted emotional distress.
I've been threatened more times than I could even count, whether it's, you know, the standard online trolls, voicemails that are left almost on a daily basis, being called a traitor to this country. I can't even begin to describe, you know, what effect this has had on my life, but it's been profound.
Coomer says the first threat happened 5 days after the election. A conservative podcaster in Colorado alleged without evidence that he heard Coomer on a phone call with Antifa.
Eric is the Dominion guy.
The threats quickly escalated. Within days, Coomer had moved to a secure location. About a week later, a group protested in front of Dominion's Denver headquarters with American flags and signs saying fraud equals arrest. A spokeswoman for Dominion says other employees have also gone into hiding, been threatened, and digitally stalked. A quick search online reveals people calling for Coomer to be publicly executed, his head to be cut off. Multiple people ask, where is Eric? Others simply bash him.
This guy clearly hates America and Trump and anyone who supports it, or him.
There is Eric Coomer, the Dominion guy who is behind all of this.
There is this psychotic communist named Eric Coomer.
Some of the threats that I've gotten have made very clear that these actors are in it for the long haul. The wishes are that I forever have to look over my shoulder, and I probably will.
The focus on Dominion had some on the right raising questions about Colorado's entire all-mail ballot system. Nearly every county uses Dominion's equipment. Carly Kappas is the incoming Republican president of the Colorado County Clerks Association. She says even though the presidential race wasn't close here, she still spends about 2 hours every day on the phone with people who have questions or are upset about the election.
Definitely have had some phone calls where people have started out with profanities and called me some lovely names. You know, I just have to remember that I am the professional.
She's trying to look on the bright side and sees this as a chance to explain why people should trust Colorado's safeguards and pioneering audits. It has the strictest standards in the country. For Eric Coomer, though, there's no silver lining. He says his life is forever changed. Coomer's top goal right now is pretty simple. He hopes one day it'll be safe to return home.
We were listening to Benta Berkland reporting there from Colorado Public Radio. I've been listening with our colleague, Miles Parks. And Miles, misinformation is dangerous, but to hear these details, I mean, it's horrifying. Do election experts say there's something that can be done?
Sure. I mean, these sorts of conspiracy theories are exactly the reason that the election security community has been so loud over the last couple of years, calling for paper ballots, calling for the sorts of audits that Benta mentioned there. But this election seems to be testing the limits of some of these election best practices. You know, in Georgia, there was a hand recount of every paper ballot there that was cast. It confirmed the results. And yet the president and some Republicans in the state are still spreading this sort of misinformation. I talked to Joe Canary, who runs a voting tech company that's working to develop more transparent voting equipment. When I talked to him, he honestly just sounded really defeated.
I'm afraid that, you know, when we're in this realm of the coupling of disinformation from both foreign and domestic sources, and government and non-government sources, and none of it is really grounded in reality, evidence doesn't help much.
At a certain point, he said, it's no longer a voting system problem. You know, the system only works if the political forces who have the trust of the people delegate that trust to the voting system. That obviously is not happening right now, and there's no amount of paper ballots or auditing that's going to fix that problem.
All right, NPR's Miles Parks. Miles, thanks for bringing all this to us.
Thank you, David.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. A winter storm warning in effect through tonight for Bayfield, Ashland, and Iron counties. Cloudy and cold today, snow showers for central and southern Wisconsin. Snow continues in the north and northeast with additional accumulations of up to 7 inches in the warning area. Highs mostly in the single digits, but reaching the low teens in the south. On Friday, Christmas Day, sunny skies with highs in the upper teens. And Saturday, partly to mostly sunny with highs in the 20s and 30s.
While the COVID-19 pandemic can feel overwhelming, the good news is that just a few simple steps can help stop the spread and save lives. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services recommends wearing a mask, washing your hands frequently, maintaining social distance, and limiting gatherings. Learn more about COVID safety, including information about testing locations and COVID activity levels in your area at dhs.wisconsin.gov.
Support for WPR comes from the Alliance. The Alliance is a not-for-profit committed to helping employers access their health data to make smarter choices. More information available at the-alliance.org/WPR.
WGTD FM is now available on your smart speaker. Simply say, play WGTD on TuneIn and hear WGTD programming. 24/7 Jazz is also available. Simply ask, play WGTD HD2 on TuneIn.
Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Writer David Sedaris once spent the Christmas season working as a department store elf, and he took notes. and it became immortal. The resulting essay was a holiday tradition on NPR, and we will hear the Santa Land Diaries coming up in about 9 minutes.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from C3. C3.ai software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai. And from AT&T, committed to keeping students and teachers connected. AT&T has connected more than 200 million students with tools and technology for distance learning. More at att.com/remote learning.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King. Good morning. The number of high school kids from rural areas applying to college has dropped in some parts of the country. It is partly because of the pandemic. Here's Maine Public Radio's Robbie Feinberg.
Good morning, Alexis.
Good morning.
How are you?
As the school day gets underway at Bucksport High School, Principal Josh Tripp welcomes students as they hop off the bus. Talk to any of them, and the conversation inevitably gravitates to the town's old paper mill. Tripp talks about the hundreds of stable manufacturing jobs that were lost when it shut down 6 years ago.
Kids know that they can't just walk out these doors, go down the street, and they're going to have that $45,000 a year job waiting for them. Doesn't mean that they have to go to college, but they have to have a plan when they leave here.
To help students with that plan, a few years ago, the high school tried to make applying to college fun. Twice each fall, it would hold FAFSA nights inside the gym to get families to fill out federal financial aid forms, a critical piece of the college application process. There'd be food, giveaways, even raffles for two laptops, incentives to get families to think beyond the jobs in town.
It's different because the mill's not there, so we're like, all right, we need to get them just to fill it out. Whether they go on to college or not, we just need them to fill it out.
In recent years, college enrollment from the school has begun to climb and now sits above the state average. But Bucksport and other communities in rural Maine are already seeing worrying signals that the pandemic is drastically altering their students' post-high school plans.
This huge gap is unprecedented, which we couldn't anticipate. So now what? What do we do about that?
Mary Callen is the project director for Gear Up Maine, an organization focused on helping rural students get into college. She says major college recruiting events, like field trips to campus, have now been replaced with emails and online presentations. And many families aren't paying attention as they deal with the stresses caused by the pandemic. Kellen says of the more than 800 students that her group helped apply last school year, more than 40% never actually ended up enrolling in college this fall.
And that's going to be very hard to recover, if we can recover it ever. I mean, that's a big drop.
Early indications for this year's high school seniors aren't much better. In rural Maine schools, the percentage who've completed federal financial aid forms is down by nearly 20%. Bucksport High School senior Ethan Lozier says he does expect to attend college next year. But after close to a year of struggling with online classes, he doesn't like the idea of spending money if he can't learn in person.
But I'm sure that there are thoughts. They've been in my mind. Why do I want to go and have online classes like this and spend many thousands of dollars?
And teachers say that they can't even get to the stage of discussing college when they see students just a few days per week, or sometimes only through a computer screen. Bucksport science teacher Katie Hunter says one student who she had lunch with every day last year has now completely fallen off the radar.
And it doesn't matter how many times we've tried to contact home, it's just impossible. You know that this person's very capable and good person, and you know that, like, I don't think they realize what this is going to do to their futures. So it's really hard.
School staff say they're trying out new strategies over the next few months to reach seniors, including texting them, offering gift cards, and even sending them snail mail, like brochures. They're hoping that may help reverse the concerning college trends, as experts worry that fewer local college students could ultimately mean fewer skilled workers, which are needed to help rural communities like this one grow. For NPR News, I'm Robbie Feinberg in Bucksport, Maine.
That story was a collaboration with the Hechinger Report. This is NPR News.
And you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. A few more minutes of the program, and then coming up at 9 o'clock, a festival of nine lessons and carols.
I'm Gregory Berg, encouraging you to subscribe to the new Morning Show podcast, which can be found on all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts, to receive a different Morning Show 7 days a week. Remember to search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
News from all over and in your community. So practice good listening with Morning Edition from NPR News every day.
Thanks for listening to Morning Edition on WPR. In sports, the Marquette men lost to Villanova last night, 85-68. And the Boston Celtics beat the Bucks yesterday by 1 point, 122-121, in the team's season opener. Milwaukee plays Golden State tomorrow.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm David Green. You think you're stressed out during the holidays? Well, try being one of Santa's little helpers. Way before social distancing was a thing, the writer and humorist David Sedaris worked as a department store elf. And it turns out being surrounded by tinsel and merriment isn't all it's cracked up to be. Lucky for us, Sedaris wrote about the downside of joy in a collection of stories called The Santa Land Diaries. And here, once again, is our Morning Edition holiday tradition, David Sedaris as Crumpet the Elf.
I wear green velvet knickers, a forest green velvet smock, and a perky little hat decorated with spangles. This is my work uniform. I have spent the last several days sitting in a crowded, windowless Macy's classroom undergoing the first phases of elf training. You can be an entrance elf, a water cooler elf, a bridge elf, train elf, maze elf, island elf, magic window elf, usher elf, cash register elf, or exit elf. We were given a demonstration of various positions in action, acted out by returning elves who were so on stage and goofy that it made me a little sick to my stomach. I don't know that I could look anyone in the eye and exclaim, "Oh my goodness, I think I see Santa." Or, "Can you close your eyes and make a very special Christmas wish?" Everything these elves say seems to have an exclamation point on the end of it. It makes one's mouth hurt to speak with such forced merriment. It embarrasses me to hear people talk this way. I think I'll be a low-key sort of elf. 22,000 people came to see Santa today, and not all of them were well-behaved. Today I witnessed fistfights and vomiting in magnificent tantrums. The back hallway was jammed with people. There was a line for Santa and a line for the women's bathroom. And one woman, after asking me 1,000 questions already, asked, "Which is the line for the women's bathroom?" And I shouted that I thought it was the line with all the women in it. She said, "I'm going to have you fired." I had 2 people say that to me today. "I'm going to have you fired." Go ahead, be my guest. I'm wearing a green velvet costume. It doesn't get any worse than this. Who do these people think they are? "I'm going to have you fired." And I want to lean over and say, "I'm going to have you killed." ¶¶ The overall cutest elf is a fella from Queens named Richie. His elf name is Snowball, and he tends to ham it up with the children, sometimes tumbling down the path to Santa's house. I generally gag when elves get that cute, but Snowball is hands down adorable. You want to put him in your pocket. Yesterday, Snowball and I worked as Santa elves, and I got excited when he started saying things like, "I'd follow you to Santa's house any day, Crumpet." It made me dizzy, his flirtation. By mid-afternoon, I was running into walls. By late afternoon, Snowball had cooled down. By the end of our shift, we were in the bathroom, changing our clothes, and all of a sudden, we were surrounded by five Santas and three other elves. All of them were guys that Snowball had been flirting with. Snowball just leads elves on, elves and Santas. This morning, I worked as an exit elf, telling people in a loud voice, "This way out of Santa Land." A woman was standing at one of the cash registers, paying for her pictures while her son lay beneath her, kicking and heaving, having a tantrum. The woman said, "Riley, if you don't start behaving yourself, Santa's not going to bring you any of those toys you asked for." The child said, "He is too going to bring me toys, liar. He already told me." The woman grabbed my arm and said, "You there, elf. Tell Riley here that if he doesn't start behaving immediately, then Santa's going to change his mind and bring him coal for Christmas." I said that Santa changed his policy and no longer traffics in coal. Instead, if you're bad, he comes to your house and steals things. I told Riley that if he didn't behave himself, Santa was going to take away his TV and all his electrical appliances and leave him in the dark. The woman got a worried look on her face and said, "All right, that's enough." I said, "He's going to take your car and your furniture and all of your towels and blankets and leave you with nothing." The mother said, "No, that's enough. Really." This afternoon, I was stuck being photo elf for Santa Santa. Santa Santa has an elaborate little act for the children. He'll talk to them and give a hearty chuckle and ring his bells, and then he asks them to name their favorite Christmas carol. Santa then asks if they'll sing it for him. The children are shy and don't want to sing out loud, so Santa Santa says, "Oh, little elf, help young Brenda here sing that favorite carol of hers." Late in the afternoon, a child said she didn't know what her favorite Christmas carol was. Santa Santa suggested "Away in a Manger." The girl agreed to it, but didn't want to sing because she didn't know the words. Santa Santa said, "Oh, little elf, come sing Away in the Manger for us." It didn't seem fair that I should have to solo, so I sang it the way Billie Holiday might have sang if she'd put out a Christmas album. "Away in a manger, no crib for a bed. The little Lord Jesus laid down his sweet head." Santa Santa did not allow me to finish. This evening I was sent to be a photo elf. Once a child starts crying, it's all over. The parents had planned to send these pictures as cards or store them away until the child is grown and can lie, claiming to remember the experience. Tonight I saw a woman slap and shake her crying child. She yelled, "Rachel, get on that man's lap and smile or I'll give you something to cry about." Then she sat Rachel on Santa's lap and I took the picture, which supposedly means, on paper, that everything is exactly the way it's supposed to be, that everything is snowy and wonderful. It's not about the child or Santa or Christmas or anything, but the parents' idea of a world they cannot make work for them.
You know it's Christmas Eve when you hear the writer and humorist David Sedaris reading here from his Santa Land Diaries. We appreciate you listening to the program this morning on your public radio station, and stay in touch throughout the day. You can find us on social media, visit the Morning Edition Facebook page, and we are all over Twitter. You can find me at NPR Green. Noel King is at Noel King. Rachel Martin is at Rachel NPR, and Steve Inskeep is at NPR Inskeep. And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King.
And I'm Melissa Ingalls. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. A festival of nine lessons and carols from King's College, Cambridge is up next.
Support for WPR comes from Gale Ambrosius Chocolatier. Open Monday through Thursday for curbside pickups with shipping and in-Madison delivery. Thanking customers for their support during this uncertain time. GaleAmbrosius.com.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. The staff at Piasecki Funeral Home can help you plan a meaningful funeral or memorial service. They consider it an honor to serve families in their community since 1931. KenoshaFuneralHome.com.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine,